complicated of questions. And yet Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam answered each and every one of them. Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam stated, "He who approves of a wicked deed partakes in it." Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are humbly talking about the dialogues of the ninth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. This divinely appointed Imam, we find that in his era, the Abbasid caliphs really put a lot of pressure and a lot of surveillance upon this divinely appointed Imam, making life very difficult for him. We find that in the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, the idea and the concept and the different variables and aspects surrounding the 12th divinely appointed Imam was something that was discussed within various circles, both the circles of the companions of the Imam and the circles of the enemies of the Imam. Now, of course, this discussion on behalf of the companions of the Imam was done because the 12th divinely appointed Imam, or the Qa'im, may Allah hasten his reappearance, was the one who was going to bring fairness and justice and free the people from oppression. So, of course, the companions and the followers and the Shia and even the Muslims in general who were under the oppression of the Abbasid governmental establishments were looking forward to this awaited savior who will free the downtrodden and the oppressed from the shackles of oppression and tyranny. And on the other hand, the circles that were the enemies of the Imams, of course, they spoke about the Qa'im and the Mahdi because of the fact that he will come and destroy and annihilate oppression and tyranny. And so the Abbasid governmental establishment very well knew that it is their own establishment which is going to be destroyed and taken down because the governmental establishment of the Abbasids was the manifestation of oppression and tyranny upon the common masses. And so the idea and the concept and the variables and the aspects surrounding the awaited savior and the Qa'im from the family of the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alaihi wasallam was something which was commonly talked about. In one conversation we find that one of the descendants of Imam Hassan alayhi salam, the second divinely appointed Imam, by the name of Abdul Azim al-Hassani, asked a question regarding the 12th divinely appointed Imam and the Qa'im to Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Now, Abdul Azim al-Hassani was a companion of the ninth divinely appointed Imam, and so he asked him about the Mahdi, and he asked him about the Qa'im and the qualities. And so Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, he replies and he says that Allah will prepare the affairs for the Qa'im as Allah had prepared the affairs for Moses, Prophet Musa, where Allah sent him to bring a fire. But when he came back to the people, he came back as a prophet of his nation. And then Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam adds, "The best deed of our Shia is the awaiting for deliverance."
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Just talking about the first part of this dialogue, and I will leave the second part for another session because it has quite a bit of things that can be spoken about. But this idea that Allah will prepare these affairs for the Imam. So one thing is we shouldn't think that everything is upon the metaphorical shoulders of the Almighty Allah. Allah has to do everything and I should do nothing. This is one of the reasons why potentially the reappearance of the divinely appointed Imam continues to be delayed, right? Because the people, you and I and the masses, they are not actively doing something on this field. But Allah says that if you try your best, then I will prepare the rest of the affairs, some of the critical affairs, affairs that, for example, are not in our hands, such as the weakening of superpowers or such as the economic financial breakdown of the capitalist system or the complete breakdown of the communist model. It is these kind of different things and factors which, of course, are relatively fundamental things in the reappearance of the divinely appointed Imam that should take place. But of course, that they're not directly in my hands or your hands. These things, yes, Allah will prepare for the Mahdi and the Qa'im, may Allah hasten his reappearance, so that it is easier for him to come and it is easier for him to be able to implement this kingdom and this government and this authority of Allah upon the earth. And then Imam al-Jawad very interestingly gives this example of Prophet Musa, where Prophet Musa, Moses, he went to the mountain to get some fire, right? He was gone for a certain period of time, but when he came back as a prophet. And so here, even though when the divinely appointed Imam went into occultation, he was the divinely appointed Imam, but still, when he comes back, you know, he will be this Qa'im. He will be this one who will stand up for truth and justice, not just for his nation, but for all nations. And he will bring about this utopian society that we are all so much in dire need of in the present day. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Jawad, alayhi salam. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parsetoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah and God bless you all.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
No matter how many times the Zionist regime may think it has defeated Palestinians, resistance will always be reborn. The end of the fabricated regime of Israel is near. In this regard, we have provided an exclusive article from the website of Electronic Intifada. Stay tuned for more. For huge numbers of Palestinians, Orey Tamimi is a role model. He was martyred defending his homeland and the dignity of his people. On October 8, Tamimi shot dead a Zionist troop near Shaafat, an Al-Quds area refugee camp. Although there were a number of other troops on the scene, none managed to capture or kill Tamimi. After he fled, Tamimi remained at large for 11 days. During that time, the Zionist regime forces locked down Shaafat and conducted extensive searches to try and locate Tamimi. Locals in the camp did their best to foil the manhunt. Many youths shaved their heads so that they would resemble Tamimi and confuse the Zionist regime troops searching for him. Tamimi came out of hiding on October 19th in a highly dramatic way. He did so by shooting at the Zionist regime security guards near Male Adumim, an enormous settlement in the West Bank. Tamimi promptly came under fire himself, yet kept shooting even as he lay on the ground, injured. He was martyred a short time later. Once his martyrdom was confirmed, the Israeli regime's press published a video of Tamimi falling down amid a shower of bullets. It is not clear if the intention behind circulating these images was to allay the Zionist regime fears or to humiliate Palestinians. Regardless of the intention, the move backfired. Thanks to the video, we have clear proof of Tamimi's exceptional bravery. Tamimi's final moments show the Palestinian victim standing up to the Zionist regime's aggressor. A Palestinian whose homeland has been stolen courted martyrdom. Such bravery does not emerge from nowhere. It stems from a belief in the justice of the Palestinian cause. Thank you. The story of Uday Tamimi must be placed within a larger context. Over the past few months, the situation in the West Bank has changed markedly. A new spirit has developed. People have found a new strength. Every day, Palestinians undertake some act of resistance or protest against the Zionist regime occupation. The driving force of this surge in resistance is young people who did not take part in the first or second intifadas. Uday Tamimi was just 22. Ibrahim al-Nablusi, martyred by the Zionist regime army during August, was born in 2003. Al-Nablusi was not born when Operation Defensive Shield, the Zionist regime invasion of West Bank cities nominally under Palestinian Authority control, took place in 2002. Tamimi was too young to remember it. While they were not conscious of those horrors at the time, they grew up experiencing oppression on a daily basis. They grew up amid the constant humiliations inflicted on Palestinians at the Zionist regime military checkpoints. They grew up against the backdrop of the Zionist regime's wall in the West Bank. Last year, the Zionist regime attacked worshippers in Al-Aqsa Mosque, one of Islam's holiest sites. That act of desecration was among numerous crimes committed by the fabricated regime of Israel in Al-Quds, a city it is actively colonizing. Outrage at these and other obscenities have filled the Palestine's young fighters in a revolutionary fervor. The resistance now occurring in the West Bank does not appear to have been planned by the leaders of major Palestinian factions. In recent weeks, a group known as the Lion's Den has claimed responsibility for many acts of resistance against the Zionist regime's army. Based in Nablus, this group has members of all Palestinian factions in its ranks. This represents a new sense of cooperation among young Palestinians, a cooperation that does not rely on traditional factors. Fatih Kazem is a Palestinian on the run from the Zionist regime army. The Zionist regime troops have killed two of his children in recent months, demolished his family's home, and continue to pursue him. He has refused to hand himself in. Fatih Kazem is a former security officer with the Palestinian Authority. His defiance of the Zionist regime occupation is proof that the revolutionary spirit remains strong among Palestinians. Before he was killed, Uday Tamimi wrote a handwritten note that has been posted on the internet. The handwritten message reads, "I am Uday Tamimi, a wanted man from Shafat refugee camp. My operation against the Shafat checkpoint is a drop in the raging sea of the struggle. I know that I will attain martyrdom sooner or later. I know that I will not liberate Palestine with my operation, but I want to encourage hundreds of youth to pick up their guns against the Zionist regime." Ibrahim al-Nablusi recorded a voice message shortly before his martyrdom at the hands of Israeli regime troops. As well as sending his love to his mother, he urged his comrades not to abandon their weapons after his death. In the past week, the Israeli regime killed the Lion's Den fighter Tamer al-Kelani. He had written a Facebook post which asserted that the worst of humankind is a person who remains neutral in a nation where truth is struggling against falsehood. Such messages serve as the last will and testament of a Palestinian young person. They are circulated widely after the martyrdom of their authors. Young Palestinians have their resilience reinforced by these messages. their authenticity is clear because these young people who wrote or recorded them have confronted the Zionist regime occupation directly. Until recently, it was easy to despair of the situation in the West Bank. The fabricated regime of Israel and its security coordination had made the scope for resistance narrower. The change over the past few months has been noticeable. While the Zionist regime has succeeded in limiting the actions taken by fighters somewhat, they will not destroy the determination of Palestinians to resist. The fabricated regime of Israel is in denial about the new situation. It has ignored the root cause of Palestinian resistance in the West Bank, the occupation.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Din al-Islam, dini, wal-Azam, ghayru dini, Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We are going to deal with an important subject of hijab according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But let's listen to a short biography before we start our program.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Well, we are still at the presence of Sheikh Javid, and we are talking about the hijab, just like a couple of episodes ago that we started this important subject. Sheikh Javid, I'm going to ask you about a face covering. What is the legal status or the religious law about wearing a face veil? Is it obligatory for women, actually, to obey the orders of their husbands and fathers in covering their faces?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It is obligatory for a woman to cover her body other than her face and hands. We know it very well because a woman cannot cover her face and walk in the streets. And the same is the case. She needs to use her hands in order to do things, to work in,
right.
For example, to deal with other people. So the face and the hands up to the wrist are exempted. There are exceptions.
Right.
And the rulings regarding hijab, the rulings regarding the modest covering is clear, but it is important, according to religious scholars, that the circumstances should be taken into consideration, the circumstances in which a woman lives. And it should be carefully considered. She should avoid, in fact, wearing the dress of fame, the dress of fame. You know, according to Islamic Sharia, the dress of fame, you know, that it's a dress that makes you stand out among other.
To be noticeable and conspicuous.
Yeah, noticeable, yeah. It is flashy, and it's called libas shuhra.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So it makes you, you know, quite noticeable among other women. So Islam is strictly opposed to wearing such clothing.
Yes.
And it does not make any difference whether, you know, whether it a man wears such dress or a woman wears it. So when it is eye-catching, when it is flashy, one should not wear it.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, some clothes may be very much eye-catching, very much flashy in one community, in one society, and the same cloth may not attract any attention in another society.
Right.
So it might be the libas shuhra or the dress of fame in one country, and it may not be the same in another country.
Mm-hmm. Just following this point that you raised in an answer to the previous question that I asked you, about the dress of fame, right?
Yeah.
You know, as you rightly mentioned, that in some countries, one dress may not be that much attractive, right, in comparison
yes.
with the other geographical places or countries. So just following up this line of, let's say, reasoning, in some countries, some people cover their faces, right?
Yes.
So is it permissible for a woman in a conservative society like these, like those countries where they cover the face, to uncover her face?
Of course, according to Islamic Sharia, covering the face is not mandatory.
Mm-hmm.
Islam also does not object to women who cover their faces. According to some scholars, as far as I know, covering the face is recommended, covering the face for women. But Islam does not impose this practice on women.
Right.
And therefore women are allowed to choose not to cover their faces. And so if a woman chooses not to cover her face, she is not to blame. Even if all other women start, covering their faces, and they are actually, it is that the tradition of the community or the tradition of the people in the society, the custom for the woman to cover their faces. But if a woman chooses not to cover, she is not to blame and she is not sinful. She can continue not covering her face.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javed. Let's take a short break and we'll be back. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javed is still our guest speaker, and the subject is hijab. Well, Sheikh Javed, I've been asking you questions about hijab, and you also mentioned that, this Islamic dress code, in fact, addresses, certain parts of the body, right? Not
yeah.
all, like the faces, for example, or the hands.
Yeah.
Right? But what about the neck? Is the neck area part of this Islamic dress code or hijab?
Of course. The neck must be covered by the woman, and even the lower part of the chin must be covered. And it's a matter of consensus among religious scholars. They are all agreed on this fact that the neck must be covered.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we see in some Muslim countries, unfortunately, either because of a lack of knowledge of religious teachings, religious laws, women, most of the women I see, do not cover their necks, and they just walk out in the streets. And of course, it is just something normal for some ladies. But in some other countries, like some, for example, I don't want to mention the names of those countries. Of course, there are some Muslim countries in which where not only cover their necks and chins, but they also cover their faces. So neck is, to put it in a nutshell,
mm-hmm.
neck is part of the hijab and it must be covered.
I see. Okay, and how about the religious law about socks? You said their feet should be covered,
yes.
right?
Yeah.
So what is the ruling on a woman wearing, for example, a special type of socks, like, for example, thin pattern colorful socks?
It is, according to scholars, according to His Eminence, Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, forbidden for a woman to show her adornments, And the adornments is not something, one applies like in like lotion, like, for example, mascara or something like that. It can be in the form of socks. Now, it is forbidden for a woman to show her adornments whatsoever to non-mahram. It's haram to let a non-mahram, see a woman's, adornments. And it can come in, the adornments can be in the form of clothes, it can be in the form of socks. And if the socks are, attractive, they are catching the attention of the men outside the woman's family,
then she must not wear them, or she must cover them with something.
Mm-hmm, I see. A very quick question, Sheikh. You know, some girls wear newly designed or stylish dresses, right?
Yeah.
And in light of this, they go out wearing a abaya and a veil, wearing these stylish clothes only in a family setting or situation or in front of their friends, even though these designs are often worn by unveiled women. So what's the religious law about wearing them?
Well, it is obligatory for a woman, according to what Allah Almighty says and what the Messenger of Allah has said, and also the infallible Imams have commanded to cover all parts of the body. Mm-hmm. It's for a woman. I'm speaking about a woman covering her body, you know. So it is necessary for a woman to cover her head, to cover her hair, except her face and hands from the sight of men. Of course, this is something we repeatedly are saying it. And as for how to cover up, this is the question. It is up to the woman herself, you know, to choose how to cover herself. But it is necessary that the dress she wears is not see-through, it's not transparent, and it should not reveal her attractive parts, okay? Her attractive parts. That the clothes must be loose. It should not be, tight or close-fitting. And therefore, it should not be... The dress she wears must not lure men, you know, and cause men to be sexually aroused somehow. And that's the point everyone understands. You know, every woman knows that whether the clothes she wears is of this nature or not. Does it attract men or women, or it doesn't? So if it does, she must not wear it.
Mm-hmm. So yes. In plain terms, she don't have to actually look hot.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Let me say it in just one sentence. The clothes she wears must not be see-through.
Yeah.
It must not be tight. It should not be revealing.
Mm-hmm.
And it should be loose.
Yes.
And it should not show the attractive parts of her body.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javed. And thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم من جاء إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
It was a long wait that ended in a cry of joy. Former president and left-wing candidate Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva won the second round of the Brazilian presidential election against the incumbent far-right leader Jair Bolsonaro. With 50.9% of the vote, the leader of the Workers' Party obtained a narrow victory over his opponent, who received 49.1% of the vote. The election was Brazil's most polarizing poll since its return to democracy in 1985 after a military dictatorship. It also marked the first time that the sitting president failed to win re-election. Just over 2 million votes separated the two candidates. Addressing his supporters in a speech following the announcement of his victory, the newly elected president promised to unite a divided country. The veteran leftist leader said his win is a victory for a democratic movement above the interests of parties and ideologies.
This is not my victory, nor of the Workers' Party, nor of the parties that supported me in the campaign. It is a victory of the immense democratic movement that was created beyond the political parties, individual interests and ideologies for democracy to win.
Lula made a stunning comeback while the public credited him with building an extensive social welfare program during his previous tenure in office, helping lift millions into the middle class and being in charge of a booming economy. During the election campaigns, Bolsonaro tried to shift the debate to Lula's corruption convictions in 2018, which were later overturned by the country's top court. However, he failed. Bolsonaro's popularity never exceeded 40% during his 4 years in office. He faced wide criticism over a slew of issues, including his handling of the COVID-19 pandemic, inflation, and high fuel prices. He has been widely criticized by public health experts for his failure to respond to the pandemic in a timely fashion and reluctance to introduce restrictive measures in fear of damaging the economy. Just 4 out of 10 households have access to food of adequate quality and quantity. The majority, 58.7%, live with some level of food insecurity. This is equivalent to around 125 million people. Also, large-scale deforestation of the Amazon accelerated under Bolsonaro, reaching a 15-year high in 2021. In his third term, Lula has inherited a sluggish economy, tighter budget constraints, and a more hostile legislature from the country's most right-wing government in decades. Lula has vowed a return to state-driven economic growth and social policies that helped lift millions out of poverty when he governed Brazil from 2003 to 2010. Soon after the announcement of Lula's victory in the tight runoff presidential vote, congratulations poured in. Among the list of world leaders who rushed to express their joy about Lula's victory was a long list of regional leftist leaders, including Argentina's Alberto Fernandez and Mexico's Andrés Manuel López Obrador. Lula's win is the latest example of Latin American countries choosing to dethrone incumbent parties on the right and center-right of the political spectrum. From Mexico in the north to Chile in the south, the region's political map suggests Latin America is set to see a new wave of pink tide of leftist governments that swept into power in the 1990s. The return of leftist governments in the region would bring closer cooperation across Latin America and is a clear indication of region-wide rejection of U.S. policies. Experts believe that the emergence of leftist politicians in Latin America will expand China's circle of friends in the region based on the fact that Latin America will attach more importance to political and economic cooperation with Beijing. Washington has for years backed the wrong players in the region, many educated or trained in the U.S., but Americans have turned a blind eye to the civil society's demands for change in the region, which has meant the departure of the U.S. favorite actors.
The German Chancellor and the French President met in Paris to recalibrate their relations, as there seems to be a rise in tensions over issues related to energy, economy and defense between Europe's two biggest economies. Germany and France are the driving forces behind many of the key decisions made by the European Union, such as a plan to raise billions of euros in debt to cushion the blow of the pandemic.
We are the biggest supporter of Europe. We are paying 26% of the budget usually, and we are developing a lot of solidarity mechanisms, as we did in the last crisis, looking at Corona, with the instruments we developed with the RRF and the Recovery Fund, is a good chance for acting together also in the time we have now.
But amongst the differences in their policies that have become cause for fallouts, Scholz and Macron seem to be on the same page when it comes to seeing European investments being hijacked by the US as a result of new policies in Washington. Macron believes that as businesses are given incentive to, quote, buy American, France will lose 8 billion euros. What Macron is referring to exactly is the biggest climate and energy package in US history, recently signed by Joe Biden. The Inflation Reduction Act of 2022, or the IRA, includes $600 billion in spending in total, with $370 billion dedicated to supporting renewable energy and climate resilience. Washington is hoping to find the budget for the package by sorting out large corporations' long-running tax evasions, as well as those of the top 1%, whether or not the corporations and the elite will still be able to evade taxes, as they've been doing for so long, remains to be seen, though. One of the measures in the IRA includes tax rebates for buyers of American-made electric vehicles, among many other industry credits for clean energy initiatives. These incentives will move operations from France to the US to take advantage of these subsidies, according to Macron. He's even called the IRA measures unfairly protectionist. There is agreement among the EU bloc members that tangible and concrete measures need to be taken. Among the potential responses that the EU could give to the IRA policy is filing a complaint to the World Trade Organization that would call for adding European-made products to become a part of the US rebate plan. In an interview with France 2 TV channel, Emmanuel Macron proposed his response to the US measure. We need a Buy European Act like the Americans. We need to reserve our subsidies for our European manufacturers. Macron even referred to similar policies in China, saying, you have China that is protecting its industry, the US that is protecting its industry, and Europe that is an open house. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, while not a big fan of the Buy European rhetoric, shares Macron's concerns over the unfair US competition. He is especially hurt when he found out that German chemical giant BASF is planning to cut down its business activities in Germany, as the company's chief says the gas prices in Germany are 6 times higher than in the US, and increasing EU regulations aren't helping his business either. German Finance Minister Christian Lindner has acknowledged that and responded by saying, the decision of a successful company like BASF showed that we need to improve the overall attractiveness of Germany as a business location. He also said Germany needs to pursue tax relief for private investors. Now Scholz and Macron are trying to reach an agreement with Washington to sort out their differences through a newly formed US-EU Task Force on the Inflation Reduction Act.
Whoa! Ladies and gentlemen, after years and years of hard work, it's official. Macron is coming to central New York.
It remains to be seen whether the deindustrialization that is plaguing Europe, mainly as a result of the energy crunch that is causing the exodus of European countries from the bloc, but now also because of Washington's incentives for investors in the US, can be fixed through reaching a compromise with the US. Because the alternative would be either a transatlantic trade war or an even bigger economic slump for a Europe unattractive to companies and investors, new and old.
A special meeting has been held by the UN, titled UN Security Council Counterterrorism. The focus was on technology and the rapid rise in digitization, the use of new and emerging technologies to counter terrorism. In the meeting, the UN cited the important roles that victims and their networks can play in countering terrorism, and to pay tribute to India and how it was a terrorism victim back in 2008.
Excellencies, distinguished guests,
ladies and gentlemen, let me extend a warm welcome to all of you in Mumbai, the financial capital of India, for attending this soft opening of the special meeting of the Counter-Terrorism Committee of the Security Council, as well as the informal briefing on countering the financing of terrorism in national and regional contexts.
Yet there was one country that was not mentioned, one which has been a victim of terrorism, one which was a victim of a terrorist attack just the day before, namely the Islamic Republic of Iran. The U.S. representative at the U.N., Chris Liu, said things like, "Today was a powerful reminder that this is really about people's lives." He also said, "We send our sympathies to the Indian people, we stand in solidarity with them, and we are committed to ensuring that the perpetrators of this horrific attack are brought to justice." But no mention of Iran, especially since it lost 13 lives due to a terrorist attack, or the over 17,000 lives that it lost due to the MKO terrorist cult. Not that Iran was looking for sympathy from the U.S. After all, Iran's top intelligence bodies issued a joint statement just yesterday pointing to the major role of foreign intelligence agencies, especially the CIA, in orchestrating the violent riots in Iran in the past weeks. The announcement said intelligence evidence shows that the CIA had devised an extensive plan with the cooperation of allied spy services and reactionary proxies before the start of the unrest to initiate a nationwide chaos with the aim of committing crimes against the great Iranian nation. In short, the intelligence ministries said the CIA played the main role while closely cooperating with the spy agencies of the UK, Israel, and Saudi Arabia. This should not come as a surprise, especially since the U.S. has executed color revolutions. In short, exporting wars, launching color revolutions, fomenting extremist ideologies, and promoting economic instability, especially through sanctions, are just some of the actions by the U.S. which has resulted in bloodshed and turmoil around the world. Some of those countries include Cuba, Ukraine, Syria, Iran, and Venezuela. Here is a man who has openly advocated for support for these rioters and who has said that the U.S. has been involved in U.S. regime change operations, former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton.
I disagree with that. As somebody who has helped plan coup d'etat, yeah, not here, but, you know, other places, it takes a lot of work. And that's not what he did. It was just stumbling around from one idea to another. Ultimately, he did unleash the rioters at the Capitol. As to that, there's no doubt.
But Iran has been one of the biggest victims of terrorism. Deputy Chief of Iran's Judiciary and head of the country's human rights headquarters, Kazem Gharibabadi, has blamed Western countries for their double standard policies on terrorism and described his nation as the biggest victim of terrorism. He said on the one hand, they accuse Iran of violating human rights, but on the other, they martyr 17,000 innocent Iranian citizens through terrorism or violate the rights of millions of Iranians through the imposition of unilateral sanctions and jeopardize their right to life. The U.S. administration and its allies are now looking to convene an informal private meeting of the U.N. Security Council on recent Iranian riots as an attempt to advance their political agenda. Imagine that, the ones committing instability in Iran to then discuss Iran's domestic affairs, among them the recent violent riots. The Iranian reaction has been swift. Iran's permanent mission to the UN said, given the hypocrisy and the use of double standards and selective practice of human rights, we regard American claims in support of Iranian women to be deceptive and lacking in good faith. He also stressed that based on reports by Iran's intelligence community, the U.S. itself was the main suspect behind the recent riots in Iran. And to make the situation even more hypocritical, according to a note outlining the events, it said it's the U.S. and Albania which will hold the informal U.N. Security Council gathering to happen on Wednesday. Of all countries, Albania, which has for years hosted anti-Iran terrorists in collusion with the U.S., the MKO, the same terrorist cult which the U.S. named as a terrorist entity once, but then took that label away. Albania does not only host this terrorist cult, but it has turned its country into a hub of interference by the terrorist group and countries hostile to Iran. It enjoys freedom of activity, even after being delisted by the European Union and the US in 2009 and 2012 respectively of the terrorist label. So it came as no surprise that the MKO terrorist cult was also actively involved in the recent riots in Iran. The findings of Iran's top intelligence body said that 49 MKO terrorists had been arrested. The terrorists were responsible for spreading fake news, instructing rioters to organize acts of terror and destruction, to direct slogans, and to be present on the streets to damage public property. This was in addition to the 77 members of anti-Iran terrorist groups that had also been arrested in the Iraqi Kurdistan region. 5 members of the Takfiri terrorist groups were also arrested in possession of 36 kilograms of explosives that were to be used to carry out bombings and gatherings. The ministry has further announced that 92 people affiliated with the former U.S.-backed Pahlavi regime had been arrested. It added that 9 nationals from Germany, Poland, Italy, France, the Netherlands, and Sweden were also arrested during the riots. Iranian intelligence ministry said a significant number of pistols, various types of machine guns and cartridges, as well as shotguns and ammunition were also seized. So it is quite hypocritical that the U.S. and its European allies impose sanctions on Iran for what they claim is a heavy-handed crackdown on violent protesters, and then move to convene a UN session on how to ratchet up further pressure on the Iranian government. Hypocritical also, since the US and these European countries have all been doing the same to their own population, especially the US.
After the Friday prayers, people of Iran poured into the streets to express their disgust at the heinous act of terror by Daesh Takfiri terrorists and ask for revenge against the group. Iran's leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei has already assured the nation that the perpetrators will face due punishment. President Ebrahim Raisi has also said that the root cause of the crime has been identified and that Iran will deliver a decisive blow to the architects and operatives of this plot, a blow that will make them regret ever committing such act. Daesh had already tried to pull off similar terrorist attacks in the country when they plotted the parliament attack and the bombing of Ayatollah Khomeini's mausoleum that left a dozen Iranians dead. Iran's anti-terror attacks ramped up significantly following the attacks on its soil through Iran's martyred anti-terror icon, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. While these were the only attacks on Iran claimed by Daesh, there have been several other terrorist attacks by other, more globally obscure but equally vicious groups. Among them, the Mujahideen-e-Khalq organization, or the MKO, has the highest body count. 17,000 Iranians have died at the hands of the vile group that even joined forces with former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein during the Iran-Iraq war to carry out cross-border attacks. For years, the group was even on the U.S. list of terrorist groups before it was removed from the list in 2012 to receive funding more easily. Funding such as the massive annual events that the MKO manages to organize without having any backing by the people of Iran, neither inside the country nor outside. These events are often attended by top U.S. officials such as Donald Trump's attorney Rudy Giuliani, former National Security Advisor John Bolton, or a number of British members of parliament to at least attempt to give the so-called Free Iran Conventions the legitimacy it sorely lacks. Among other terrorist groups that, while definitely not on the scale of the previously mentioned two, have still tried to deprive Iran of its security, we can name Jandallah terrorist group led by Abdul Malik Righi. Righi's group was responsible for the death of tens of Iranians in the southeast province of Sistan and Baluchistan before he was arrested and executed by Iranian authorities. Separatist groups such as Al-Ahwaziya and the Kurdish Komala have also been responsible for a few terrorist attacks in the west of Iran, with the latter serving a prominent role in the recent riots across the country. But their plot to capitalize on the riots to further their separatist agendas was quickly foiled by Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. The IRGC carried out 2 ballistic missile attacks on Komala's bases in Iraq's northern Kurdistan region. The IRGC had warned Iraq prior to the attack that Iran will not tolerate the existence of such groups who were, as reported by the IRGC, plotting to attack Western Iran in its neighborhood. According to a joint statement between Iran's Ministry of Intelligence and the intelligence organization of the IRGC, involvement of the U.S. in the recent riots in Iran has been proven. The U.S. and its spy agencies have even branched out their plans in three stages: before, during, and after the unrests.